Welcome to the More Perfect Union Podcast, a regular discussion on the state of American politics and current events with entertaining and respectful commentary from across the political spectrum. Hello and welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics. I'm Alan, a conservative slash libertarian from Michigan.
I'm Kevin. I live in Los Angeles, and I'm a Democrat with a slight lean toward the conservative side.
I'm Greg, a stay-at-home dad from Cincinnati, who is your liberal Democrat tonight.
I'm DJ from Suffolk, Virginia, cost estimator and economics instructor, self-described economic conservative, and self-confessed Republican.
You can find us on the web at moreperfectpodcast.com. You can go to Facebook, facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And if you'll do us the favor, go to iTunes and rate us and review us. Give us 5 stars and tell us that we're amazing or that we suck or whatever. But tell us because we want to know. Go to iTunes. All right, you guys, big week this week. Let's start with Tuesday was Election Day 2015, and there are a few races that were pretty exciting. I'm going to hand this one off to DJ. Tell us a little bit about Kentucky.
Well, Kentucky was, I think, the election that got most people's attention, but for the most part, there were elections in the Northeast, there were elections deeper in the South, and it was largely a continuing, in my opinion, of the political sorting and sifting that we normally see. I mean, Republicans won 4 of the 6 statewide races in Kentucky. They won nearly all the statewide races in Mississippi. But if you go northward in New Jersey, Democrats gained 3 seats in the General Assembly, New Jersey's lower house. They won back the district attorney's job in Staten Island, and they won the district attorney's job in Nassau County.
In general, the conservatives are crowing, is what you're saying, though. The conservatives are pretty happy because it seems that the Republicans did pretty well. Would you agree?
I would say that they are happy because it seems like they did well. They won the top line races.
They did do well. It doesn't seem like they did well. They did do well.
Oh, yeah, they did very well. I mean,
the Kentucky governorship was not expected. Is that right? That was he came on pretty strong in the end. Is that right?
Well, I think it's another example of just the great Follies. They got a whole bunch of races in 2014 wrong. They got the British election in 2015 spectacularly wrong. They were behind the liberal surge in Canada last month, and they screwed up in Kentucky too. Pollsters just really having a bad year.
Well, I would say the Republicans felt like 2012 was a pretty bad year for pollsters because the Republicans were pretty sure Mitt Romney had it locked up, if you remember correctly.
Well, the pollsters got that right. It was one guy on examiner.com, which is not really a valid news source.
No, I think you're right. The 538 blog really made their bones at that point. That was right.
Right.
But I would go a little farther than that. Gallup, the last Gallup poll, which was the morning before the election, had Mitt Romney ahead by 1 point. He lost by 4. And Gallup, in fact, was so spooked by what happened that they're not going to be doing any horse race polling in 2016. Now, state pollsters, for the most part, got things right. They did a good job. But Gallup, in particular, got burned in 2012. Mm-hmm. And so much so they're not doing it in 2016.
I just remember that morning, all the conservative pundits were flabbergasted. They were pretty surprised. However, like you said, the 538 – there were a lot of people that were calling it for Obama way ahead, but all the conservative pollsters were not all of them, but a lot of them were really surprised. I remember that. So this just feels kind of like that again, you know?
The conservative pollsters had a term, and I'm trying to remember what it was. Was it unbiased polls or they were, what was the term they all used? Like
the exact term was unskewed polls. The guy who came up with that. As with so many things where people fall flat on their faces, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
It was a terrible idea. Yeah.
The biggest thing was
unscientific.
For a lot of us on the right, what really was a lot of us followed the Rasmussen poll, which had Romney ahead for the most part. And then we saw the Gallup poll, which at least nationally had Romney ahead. And then essentially, you know, all the state polls and every other pollster out there said, no, we think 2012 will look a lot like 2008 in terms of the electorate, and given that, Obama should be ahead, and that's essentially what happened. I think for most of us on the right who are going to look at the Kentucky race, we're going to look at the fact that the Virginia Senate was held by the Republicans. They're going to go, oh, that's great. It's a good year for Republicans. It means good for 2016. Well, yeah and no. We won in Kentucky, where really we should win. Virginia, we won in the places we should have won. We lost in the places we should have lost. We lost in New Jersey. We lost in New York. But in Pennsylvania, where everyone is supposed to say that's one of the states that we're supposed to flip and that we have to flip, I don't know where they get that from. The Democrats won all three state Supreme Court elections up there. They're the only statewide race in 2015. If you look at the 2015 races in totality, Republicans really shouldn't be as happy as they would be if they just looked at the top line races. Unfortunately, too many of us will look at just the top line races.
Greg, well, I have a question for Greg. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the controversy surrounding that Kentucky race.
Right. The controversy was something that we talked about. We talk a lot about is down voting, down ticket voting. Okay. So if someone votes for the governor, and I know DJ and I have already talked a little bit about this, and he's all over this already, but if someone votes for the governor, then the down ticket, then they should also vote. If they vote for a Democrat governor, then they should vote down ticket even more for Secretary of State. And it should pretty much go down that way. Democrat, boom, 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 boom. Well, what happened was, Belvin, won by 9 points. So you should have seen the next couple big races down be also Republican. It didn't happen. In fact, the next two big races were Democrats. So there was this conscious choice to say, oh, Republican, boom, boom, Democrat. Okay. And then to Republican, which doesn't really happen that often. In fact, it's a fluke. Rarely happens. Okay. In Ohio, we had a big change in when Kasich came in, and it went right down the guard. Republican, 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 top three seats went.
So as I understand it, there are two theories here. One is that there was some type of scandal or some vote cheating.
No. It was a cheat. It was a complete voter fraud. That's one theory.
Or the other theory is that there was some ticket splitting going on, which could mean a whole different thing for Republicans and Democrats.
Yes. Yes.
And if I may, if you actually look at the numbers, and I have them right here in front of me.
Sure.
The only two Democrats that withstood the tide in Kentucky were the Secretary of State, Alison Lundgren Grimes, who is not only the incumbent Secretary of State, which always helps, but mm-hmm. she was the nominee against Mitch McConnell just last year. So she had much more name recognition than your typical Secretary of State candidate in general.
Oh, she had national name recognition.
Yeah, right. The Attorney General was Andy Beshear, who was the son of the outgoing governor of the state. So he had some name recognition advantage. Now, in Ohio, John Kasich might have been able to sweep the coattails for all the other Republicans running. But I can tell you here in Virginia, split tickets are much more the norm. In 2005, when Tim Kaine was elected governor, there was a Republican-elected lieutenant governor and a Republican-elected attorney general. When Mark Warner was elected governor in 2001, he got a Democratic lieutenant governor, but a Republican attorney general. In 1993, 58% of the voters went for a Republican candidate for governor, and 53% of the voters went for a Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor.
Okay, so you're saying that you believe it's ticket splitting. Okay.
Yes, I do. I believe it is.
You know, the other reason everyone is just shocked by it is because no one can believe that people would be voting against their self-interest, because this Belvin guy said, yeah, I'm going to change the Obamacare, the Medicaid gap, and I'm going to just dump hundreds of thousands of people, and maybe millions. I think it might be tens of millions.
And no, it's a few hundred thousand.
It's a few hundred thousand. I'm engaging in hyperbole at this point.
Yeah, there are not tens of millions of people who live in the state of Kentucky, Greg.
I know.
And the other thing you have to realize, and Democrats continually forget this, and Republicans overemphasize this, is that there are a lot of people who have, in fact, been damaged by Obamacare, who lost insurance that was dropped because it didn't meet the rules. And maybe they managed to get it back through the exchange, or maybe they managed to get it back through Medicaid. But in their minds, they now have inferior insurance because of the ACA and the ramifications. And they
let's not go down the Obamacare rabbit hole now.
Right, we've already spent forever.
We've already spent about 10 minutes on Kentucky, which is longer than I spend on a meal at Kentucky Fried Chicken. So maybe we've given this issue its due.
Let's talk about a show that is particularly close to your heart, Kevin. Tell us a little bit about Trump last night on Saturday Night Live.
Well, as you guys know, and maybe some of our 15 listeners know, I actually was a writer on Saturday Night Live for a few years in the 80s, so I have a little bit of knowledge of that, how that place works. But anyways, as the world knows, Donald Trump has now hosted SNL for his second time. It was not a good show. It was not a horrible show. I'd give it a C minus or a D.
The reviews were overwhelmingly poor. Every place I read said it kind of stunk.
Yeah, well, of course, there was a lot of expectation as well.
Sure.
Lorne made some very questionable choices about sketches, but there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that goes into what gets on the air and what doesn't. But the highlight of the show for me actually had nothing to do with Trump. It was the cold opening that was a parody of past Friday's Democratic Forum in South Carolina, where Larry David once again did his Bernie Sanders impression, and I thought he stole the show.
You know, Larry David is Bernie Sanders. That's the thing. It's barely an impression. They might actually be the same person. It's creepy. He does a really good job.
Yeah, and I saw Sanders on a couple of the morning talk shows today, and I'm convinced that he is now trying to change his speaking style to stay away from some of those habits that David is now parodying so effectively. He doesn't use his hands anymore. He tries to stay calm. But as the interview goes on, he can't help himself. And it gets funny because the hands come up and he goes into that parody of himself.
And that just, I think, emphasizes to me how much Bernie Sanders is a 20th century politician. Because in the 21st century, you advance by scoring jokes against yourself. In the 21st century, Bernie Sanders should be noting the mocking and actually playing up to the mocking.
No, he has been doing that. He has been doing that, but he doesn't know. But when you see yourself being parodied, and then maybe you have people around you who say, hey, this is, you're becoming Sarah Palin now, which I think, quite frankly, David's impression might be coming. Then you start becoming self-aware. It's hard not to. Ed Sullivan was self-aware of Ed Sullivan impressions.
You know what, though? Bernie has potential to be lovable. He's like the lovable old communist uncle. He really has potential to be lovable. I don't know that much about him, and I like him every time. I like him more every time I see him. Not that I'd vote for him, but his personality is, he's sort of lovable in this sort of crazy. He's like your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving. Your crazy liberal uncle / communist uncle.
Right.
Back to the Trump aspect, though. There was one skit of the Trump where they say it's 2 years into the Trump White House and all America's problems have been solved. And, they keep coming in. They're like, everything's been fixed. And the Mexican president comes in and says, oh, Trump, here's that check. It's a little bit more, but, it's worth it to build that great wall and all this stuff. And I couldn't help but thinking they were making fun of him. They were like, Trump, none of this is going to ever happen. And we're making fun of you. And he was sitting there going, yeah, this is right. This is all right. And the end of the skit was paid for by his wife's pack or something like that. That was the skit, was like,
and they tried to break the fourth wall. What happened there is it was a horrible, horrible sketch. From a writing perspective, this sketch could have been written by 11th graders, and maybe that's even too kind. Well, it was right. One of the worst political sketches that I've ever seen on one of these shows. And, there's a reason that these things get on the air. And it did. It actually also hurt his candidacy. Yes, right. I agree.
But they were making fun of him to his face, and I don't think he realized
it. You don't think
it.
He got it?
He got it. He knows that. He knows that.
No, I think he's completely. There were times where I think that he realized they were made, like the opening monologue. I think he got it when they had the guys. He got it. I don't think he got it on that one. That one we could disagree. I mean, I really do think he's. I'm making a motion in front of my microphone right now where my hand is going over my head. I'm sure you all saw that.
Yep. Thanks for that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Did you decide to see?
You know, I will tell you again, maybe you guys know this, but I'll try to do this very quickly, how the show works. You know, you've got a large staff of writers. They're turning out sketches, especially with a host like this. You're even more motivated to get a lot of material written. So you go into the read through on Wednesday. There are 40, 45 pieces, and you can only mount 10 sketches, of which 8 make the final show. And what might have happened is, because I don't, you know, this sketch was just not a professional sketch from a writer's perspective. So what might have happened is they might have had another sketch that was supposed to take place in the Oval Office that fell apart. And they may have had to write this thing at the last minute to fill that stage space because they knew they needed a block piece with a President Trump premise. I've actually been in that position before where the producer of the show came to me and some other writers and said, look, we had a sketch that was supposed to be a Reagan-Jesse Jackson sketch. That's how long ago I worked on the show. And it fell apart, and we need you to write another piece that takes place in the Oval Office with Reagan and Jesse Jackson. It's writing to order, and usually that's the worst kind of writing.
No pressure. Done on shows. Yeah, no pressure. You've got a set already built, and you've got characters. Make it funny.
Right.
Make it funny.
Now, I don't know that that happened here, but this was just an abomination from a comedy perspective. This has nothing to do with Donald Trump. This was an abomination from a comedy perspective.
He's just an abomination from a political
perspective. Well, they were just waiting for there. He was a train wreck that a lot of people were going to watch one way or the other, though. So
yeah, and they got tremendous ratings, and they're going to
they got some of the best ratings ever this year. Yeah.
So they don't care, you know. Nobody cares. Listen, they do good shows. They do bad shows. All they care about is the ratings.
So who are they going to try and bring on next? I think Hillary's already been on. So
good question.
Actually, well, Hillary did well was the difference, though. She actually kind of did well.
They'll bring on Sanders.
Their next host will be General Ben Carson.
Maybe.
But well,
in the West Point graduate.
That's what we call in the business. What we call a segue. Let's talk about Ben Carson. He's had kind of a he's had a rough week, although he's in some polls he's actually ahead of Trump right now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
They're sort of fighting for the top spot right now, but he had a lot of press this week. There are like four stories where they're jumping on him for him not being honest. What about someone tell me about the West Point thing? It's from a book, right?
From what I can tell, he had said that he was quote offered a full scholarship to West Point. Now, folks who know that you go to West Point free anyway, you promised to serve for 5 years, probably thought that was a little odd. Politico did some examination of it and found that, you know, he never really applied, and he never was offered a spot. Then apparently Politico got some of their own reporting, a couple of mistakes there. Nothing that absolves Carson or anything.
Exactly.
But then Politico being a bunch of idiots in this, goes back and changes its story without acknowledging that the story was corrected.
Oh, you mean sort of like the New York Times did with Hillary Clinton? That kind of change?
No.
Right. So once again, the media accidentally made itself the story and allowed a candidate to essentially, in this case Carson, to essentially skate on something that he really should not have skated on. And
That's true.
May very well have been that he said he met General Westmoreland to discuss the possibility of going to West Point in May, or he may have actually done it in February. This is actually a nice Rorschach test for just about everybody. You see those of us in the conservative wing of the party who have frankly gone far too tribal, who just don't believe anything Politico says, don't believe anything anybody says, and who assume if the media went after Ben Carson must be right. Jeb Bush actually tried to play to those people with his statements.
I could not believe that. That was like, yeah. That speaks to Jeb Bush's position in the race, actually. But
it's desperation. Contrary to his memo, Jeb can't fix it.
Yeah.
And then you see folks outside.
Carson's probably thinking to himself, geez, not Bush. Anyone but Jeb. Sorry.
And everybody outside that little tribalist band probably looking and going, seriously?
Yeah.
What the heck happened?
You know, well, DJ, when you are right, you are so right. And in this case, you are so right. This is a Rorschach test, and it's each side going to the mattresses. And frankly, for me personally, it's opened a broader thing, which is that I think that we're putting our presidential candidates under the wrong microscope. Every person who's been president in the 20th century and into the 21st century has had several human frailties, mendacity being one of them. And the idea that we expected Ben Carson or any of these people to be a perfect holier-than-thou candidate is just a bad expectation on our part.
All right. All right. Let me interrupt. How about Carson's statements about the pyramids being grain silos, though?
That's a biblical interpretation. It's stupid.
It's weird, though. I mean, it's not. I shouldn't say it's weird because okay, now I'm going to get hate mail, because I'm questioning. But it's just one of those things. Like, that's kind of like proven that it's never been a grain silo.
Well, but that was taken. Wasn't that taken from a speech he gave in the 80s or something like that? Though that's not something he was talking about yesterday, is it?
Did he give the speech after watching Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat?
Exactly. He was like, you know, him and his Technicolor Dream. I could, you know, I mean, and he just defended it last week, saying, "No, I think that could happen." I have
We're
faith
talking
in
about.
That.
Wait. We're talking about what Ben Carson thinks about the pyramids, or whether or not he met William Westmoreland in the late 60s. Have you heard this man talk about national defense? I mean, if you've ever heard this man speak about the issues of the day, what he thinks about grain and in pyramids has nothing to do with anything. He's not legitimately ready to be president of the United States based on his understanding of the world.
Right.
And I don't disagree with that at all, Kevin. But because he has no record, in public office,
yep.
All
That's
of this
got.
Stuff becomes more important. That's all we
oh,
have.
No. I understand that. But I'm saying if anybody who listens to this man being interviewed on the issues of the day, that should disqualify him. You know what? God bless people who want to look at his character and say, well, maybe he's not the most honest person, or maybe he doesn't understand the world because he's too tied into biblical interpretations. That's all true, too, and that bothers me. But it, to me, the big issue is he doesn't even know who's at war in, like, Iraq.
Okay, let me remind you who he's neck and neck with for the top spot in the political – in the Republican side right now. I mean, this is
– Let me tell you something. Donald Trump is Dwight David Eisenhower compared to this guy.
I don't know. I find them both distasteful. But here's the thing. I look at the – he wrote that book – not even knowing if he was – he wrote that book before he was even sure he was going to be president. So you know what? They tend to put wild and crazy stuff in there. Obama's had some he had some similar things where it's like, that's not really true. And honestly, even you got Hillary with that, you know, landing under fire thing, all that stuff. You just got to figure – they all know that they blew it after the fact. These are things they think, oh, no one's really going to notice that. But what they have to understand is everyone's going to notice everything now. You can't embellish anything anymore because everyone's memory because of the internet is perfect. So you just
Look, Hillary Clinton, you know, did have a server that she shouldn't have in her home. She probably, you know, she did lie about Bosnia being under fire whatever you want to call
outright
that.
Lie, similar so, to Carson's so, outright so lie about point. Westmoreland. He did not meet Westmoreland, I guarantee it.
You know what? And Marco Rubio did play fast and loose with his credit card. And I could go down the list because I wrote this article back before people started dropping out of the race. There were 21 candidates, and I found a scandal in 20 of their backgrounds. Mm-hmm. The only person that did not have a scandal was Lincoln Chafee, and that's even debatable. So this idea that that we should look for a candidate who is above the fray, they just don't exist. Our best presidents all were philanderers. They were cheaters. They were liars. This is a job about management. And it's a job about diplomacy.
I think that's
and
fair.
We should be judging
easy,
people based on their
easy
capacity
for the opponent.
To do that job.
It's easy for the opponents to just throw that stuff in their face. The thing is, it's always good to have stuff like that to throw in their face. So it doesn't mean anything at this point, though. That's the problem because they all have it.
Let me stop here. Who is the best president in the past 100 years, quickly?
Well, for me, FDR.
FDR. Okay. Alan.
Yeah, I'm trying to. Lincoln's more than 100 years old. I was just trying to do some math.
We're not going to Lincoln.
Yeah, Lincoln's
I was going to say, clearly Lincoln's my favorite, but I think FDR was really good. I think Teddy wasn't so bad, but.
Right.
Okay. And we know he did terrible things. Okay.
Yeah. I think he would be super easy. Like, you wouldn't have to look that hard. That's very true.
No.
I think FDR is well known as a womanizer. Kennedy could.
Sure.
Kennedy clearly has that. But Kennedy was a really good president, though.
Kennedy was great. Kennedy
wasn't too bad. I think the issue here, though, is not whether or not voters care about different things differently. Voters don't care about sex anymore. They do still care about money.
You don't think they care about sex?
In terms of who they vote for, no.
I mean, people. I still can't. In my house, we still can't talk about my parents' house. I should say they still can't talk about Bill Clinton because of not the fact that he did fine with the economy, not the fact that the trade agreements or anything about that. It's because there was a blowjob. You can beep that out, from an intern.
Well, speaking of presidents of character, didn't George Bush, number 41, write a book this week? Segue.
God, you're good.
Nicely done.
Well, yeah, so he released a memoir. I forget what it's called, but it was basically in the memoir. I don't know anything about it, what I've heard from the stories, but part of it is he didn't think, he thought W got a raw deal.
He thought that
Cheney and
Rumsfeld
kind of pushed him around and took charge too much, and they were the real bad guys of the administration, and his poor son just didn't really get to do what he wanted to do, which was make peace and plant daisies and be the caring.
Well, the irony of this, though, is if you actually look at the second Bush the Younger administration, he effectively fired Rumsfeld in 2006, and he largely sidelined Dick Cheney.
Right.
I mean, as soon as Condoleezza Rice went from National Security Advisor to the State Department, she basically overshadowed Cheney and overshadowed Rumsfeld, and it was largely. She was largely the power behind the throne in the administration. It wasn't Cheney and Rumsfeld anymore. Rice was able to maneuver around them in a way that I guess Colin Powell couldn't. But the Bush family, the Bush family always protects themselves. They protect each other. And I think this was Daddy trying to make the kid look better. The one that I thought was interesting was that on the day that Dan Quayle endorses Jeb Bush for president, the book comes out where Jeb told his dad that he should drop Dan Quayle as his running mate in 1992.
Nice. That's awesome.
I did not know that. By the way, the book we're talking about.
Do you think this makes Bush? Do you think this makes Bush 43 look better, or do you think it kind of makes him look weaker?
I think it makes him look weaker from the fact that his parents, his dad and his brother. Well, okay, so his dad is making excuses like he had the wrong people, and Jeb made it sound like Jeb wanted to sort of. Make excuses for his brother's presidency, it sounded like. It was very interesting to hear Jeb. Jeb can't say anything right. I swear to God. His only hope is to keep his head down at this point. I'm telling you.
George W. Bush's reputation for most people is already encased in amber. If you like George Bush, if you like George Bush the Younger, nothing George Bush the Elder says is going to change that.
Agreed.
If you hate George Bush the Younger, nothing Bush the Elder says is going to change that. If you are ambivalent towards him like me, you can see stuff in what Bush the Elder said that reflects well on his son and that reflects badly on his son. It doesn't, it doesn't really matter. Jeb Bush is our version of Tony Blair. Just say his name and you get a reaction. You won't get the same reaction, but you'll get a reaction.
Okay. I want to jump in because I have a different take on this. And by the way, the book we're talking about is Destiny and Power by John Meacham, who's a very serious historian. Now, I have not read the book yet. I've just read a couple of excerpts online. But, you asked a good question, Alan. Who does it make Bush the Second look stronger or weaker? I think it makes George Herbert Walker Bush look weaker. And I'll give you two reasons. First of all, He had these thoughts while his son was in office, and he didn't pick up the phone and talk to him. Now, I understand, oh, he's a dad and he doesn't want to interfere, but you're a former president of the United States.
Exactly. It's different than just a dad.
You have a pipeline to the current president of the United States, and these are matters of life and death. These are matters of war and peace. And when you know that someone who worked for you and is now working for another president is giving them bad advice, it is your obligation to get on the phone, especially from the same party, and say, may I say, you know, permission to speak freely, sir, and then speak your mind. So I think that that does not speak well for George Herbert Walker Bush. The other thing that I learned in an interview this morning that I found very fascinating, John Meacham was being interviewed. He said that after winning the Gulf War, where George Herbert Walker Bush's approval rating was at 91%, which is unheard of, that he actually went into an almost depression, a funk, because he felt that the end of the war did not have a defining moment. It didn't have its battleship moment, as they say. And he felt that he had, even though he had made the right decision not to march to Baghdad and to remove Saddam from power, he felt that he would be looked on askance by history for that choice. And he's right, he was. It's very interesting to see that that man actually was in the White House as depressed as Lincoln apparently was while he was winning the Civil War, because he had won a war and nobody was giving him the credit.
Well, Nixon's greatest period of depression was after he beat McGovern in the Wamping landslide in 1972, because as Ambrose put in his biography of him, you know, Nixon was all about the struggle, and the struggle was for victory, but victory meant the struggle is over, so now there's nothing to struggle for.
Yes, so I think a lot of politicians have run into that exact problem.
Yeah. You know, when their last campaign is over, what do they do now? Yeah,
then they got to actually go to work.
Right. Know? Some go on to, you know, do foundation work or build houses for the homeless.
While and they're some, being treated for cancer.
Right. And then some, you know, do watercolors.
So what other issues should we be covering this week?
Well, talking about people who are not necessarily in their last campaign, but would be if they are optimistic enough in their next to last campaign, there was that Democratic Forum on Friday.
Right.
I didn't watch that.
I didn't even know. What is it? Kevin, what was it?
It's a series of three back-to-back interviews. Nobody knows why. Well, I know why they did it. They added it to the schedule because there was so much moaning and groaning about not being enough debates. So the DNC, you know, allowed them to do a forum instead of a debate. Obviously, MSNBC gets to sell some airtime. The candidates get to speak on a national television audience, so everybody's happy. Rachel Maddow hosted it. She talked to each one for 30 minutes. So here's the deal. Martin O'Malley was there. Bernie Sanders was there. Hillary Clinton was there. They all did well. Martin O'Malley did very well. They all articulated themselves well. They presented their ideas well. For me personally, as anyone who's listened to this podcast knows, I happen to think that Hillary Clinton is the best candidate and the best potential president. And I think that that was on display in her presentation and her interview. But there was no news to come out of it other than they all still believe that you know, their policies are better than the Republican policies, and each one of them will make the best president ever.
There you have it.
That doesn't surprise me.
That covers it. Yeah.
How did Rachel Maddow do? I mean, compared to like Coop. And...
Well, she did well. Remember, what she's doing is not the same as what the CNBC and Cooper. Anderson Cooper and the other people had to do, which is moderate, a crosstalk debate. She was just interviewing people, but she did have a couple of kind of annoying kind of hooks. Like, she would hold out these cards and say, okay, here's a fun thing. Pick a question. This is not a gotcha question. It's just a fun thing. Pick something. And so, you know, they would pick an envelope and she would read it like the Oscars. And they were goofball questions like, you know, Hillary Clinton, if you could run with one of the Republicans as your VP, who would it be?
Who'd she pick?
She wouldn't pick anybody.
Oh, come on.
She said there might be a Republican that I'd run with, just not one of them.
Christy. I'm sorry.
I would have loved to have heard that one of them took the envelope and pulled the Karnak the Magnificent and did the read the answer.
Read it before. That would have been good. That would have been awesome. I don't think any of them have the sense of humor for that, though.
By the way, going back to the SNL parody of it, when Bernie Sanders was being asked, which car do you want? He said, and this is a quote from the sketch, the one on the far left, so far left, it could never be elected president.
That was really good. I like the one on the far left. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, that was by far the best skit of the night. And I actually watched it all the way until the Sankey musical performance, which was terrible.
So we also have the Keystone Pipeline was a decision was made on that this week. Should we discuss that?
Sure. Well, I don't know how much.
I'm going to least boast because in the second edition of this podcast, I predicted this would happen.
Yes, you did.
Yes, you did.
I remember that.
Fruition. It came a little earlier than I thought it would, but that's because one, Justin Trudeau took office a little earlier than I thought, and there's the Paris conference, which starts on November 30th. Clearly, they wanted it done before then. But you know, once Harper was out of office in Canada, there was no real political impetus north of the border for this. I mean, Trudeau said he was disappointed, and Premier Notley said she was disappointed. But you know, they said they were disappointed. They didn't say they were angry. Stephen Harper would have gone on the warpath, and he would have tried to basically turn his entire country into a gigantic pipeline out to the Atlantic Ocean or something. Trudeau and Notley didn't do that. I think everybody understood that this is what's going to happen. They wanted to make a symbolic gesture that this was a different era, that they'd be looking at things differently, and that's pretty much what everybody did. So,
but there was one little switch in it. By the way, I will give you credit, DJ, because you pretty much nailed it. But there was one little spin, which was at one point about a week before Obama and Kerry came out with their decision, which was to reject it, that either the company or Canada, someone tried to pull back on it, delay the decision, hoping that a Republican would get elected in 2016 and they would be able to pass judgment on it in 2017. That little gambit didn't work. Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because TransCanada actually said they would try to make a second application and just hope that a new president would react to it differently. So they essentially did they're trying to do the same thing. I don't know really how much it's going to help. They might as well wait to see if a new president takes office. But yeah, they tried that in the hope that they could avoid an actual decision, because as soon as the decision came down, they lost like 5% of their stock value. So I think that's what they were trying to avoid.
Oh, well, here's what's going to happen. This is now going to become another issue in the presidential campaign, because already I believe Rubio has come out and said on day one, I'm going to, approve Keystone. The others are all going to do this. So this is going to be another wedge issue that, frankly, is not going to work to the Republicans' advantage in the general election.
Help me out. What was rejected? Was there legislation? He didn't veto legislation. Is this a Department of the Interior thing that he's allowed to thumbs down?
It's also an international deal, so state was, I guess, driving it. And that's why Kerry was so...
Because it's with Canada. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
That's
going to be a really busy day for all those guys on that first day. They're going to have such a busy first day.
They're going to have to get rid of Obamacare before breakfast.
In theory, January 20th, 2017 should be a very busy day.
Yeah.
In practice, one of them actually has to get elected first,
yeah,
and that's not where you bet your money.
Yeah. There's one other thing about Keystone that I find fascinating. And again, I really wasn't that interested in the topic, so I didn't read up enough on it as I should have. But I learned this week, that to build the pipeline, TransCanada would have had to use eminent domain to kick a lot of farmers off their land so the pipeline could go through. And what I find fascinating is that the Republicans and the conservatives who were the ones, backing this project, the free market people, the people of independence and the people of liberty and the people of, we should have smaller, limited government, were all for throwing people off their land so that the governments of two different countries can build a gas pipeline through their backyard.
Is it throwing people off their land, or is it taking an easement on their land? Because I'm pretty sure it doesn't disqualify them from owning all of their land. I think they would probably get an easement. That still is eminent domain, but it's not quite as dramatic as you're saying it, I think.
Yeah, well, pipeline easements, I mean, Kevin's larger point is still valid, but it's not as potent because it is more of an easement issue. It would have been fascinating to see what would have happened had the pipeline been moved forward and then the eminent domain issue became more prominent. Mm-hmm. It hadn't become – it just wasn't as prominent because the State Department kept holding it up and holding it up and holding it up, and that became the top-line issue regarding the pipeline. Had that not been the top-line issue and had it been eminent domain, that probably would have slowed it down considerably because a lot of people would have –
I agree.
Said, well, hang on, wait a minute. You need to step back and actually try to make something closer to a deal.
And should a Canadian company be, you know, taking over Americans' land? But okay, why don't we talk about the state of the races and start to wrap
things
up?
The only thing I'll add to that, though, is that, you know, a lot of people in this country believe that companies are people, and so are Canadian companies. So that would all make sense. So
I never heard that second part. The Canadian companies are people. I thought it was just U.S. corporations.
I'm pretty sure. So I think that's how they justify it. It's
then are Kenyan companies people?
Yeah, but you know, we're only allowed to make terrible memes about them, and it doesn't go well. It doesn't go well.
Okay. All right, so did you guys hear that for the next Republican debate, there's only going to be 8 on the main stage? So Christie and Huckabee got kicked down to the kids' table, and I think now, Jonah's buddy, Jonah's favorite, it's the guy from, say it again?
Lindsey Graham?
Yeah, Lindsey Graham's not even on the kids' table. So they're
Ian Pataki, you're out.
Yeah, I think that's wise on their point. I wish they would cut about 5 more of them out at this point too.
Okay.
I agree.
Yeah, how? I gave this some thought over the weekend, and because of the nature of trying to think about how this is going and how this will go. The simple fact of the matter is, except for Trump, Carson, Bush, Cruz, and Rubio, everyone else is basically betting on a good showing in Iowa or a good showing in New Hampshire to keep their campaign going. They're hoping that they can sort of catch lightning in a bottle like Santorum did in 2012 or like McCain did in 2008. Unless that actually happens, and I don't see it happening for any of them, they're all going to be gone come February 10th when the New Hampshire primary is over and they get mired in the lower single digits. And then we're going to when we go to South Carolina, it will essentially be Trump, Carson, unless they deflate, which is possible. But if they don't, it will be Trump, Carson, Cruz, Rubio. And assuming he can't beat Rubio in either of those states, which he's not now in either poll, a last desperate stand for Bush in South Carolina. If Bush can't beat Rubio in South Carolina, he's not going to risk – I don't think he's going to risk losing to him in Florida. That would be a total humiliation. Well,
at least one of Carson and Trump's going to blow up before then. Like, I'm sorry, deflate by then. I'm convinced of it. And that may be the one thing that saves Bush's bacon at this point.
Well, no, because
no.
Trump and Carson vote is not going to go to Bush.
No.
The Carson vote may go to Trump and vice versa. They may both go some to Ted Cruz. Rubio might pick some up. Not
okay,
a whole
but
lot.
Here is my thing. Do you think that the Republican, the regular Republican voter, and maybe that it's fair to say primary voters are not regular Republican voters. Are they going to pull a lever for Carson or Trump, particularly Trump? Are they really going to pull a lever for that? Or are they still enjoying the drama?
The majority of Republicans, no. But initially in Iowa and New Hampshire, the majority of Republicans are going to be scattered amongst a whole bunch of candidates.
Right.
Once you get to South Carolina, the anti-Trump, anti-Carson Republicans, their choices will be a very weakened Jeb Bush or a strong Cruz and Rubio. And I'm guessing
Cruz is too crazy. I actually enjoy listening to him because he's a pretty good speaker, but he's too crazy. So it's going to be Rubio and Bush. I'm telling you, it's going to be Rubio and Bush. And I mean, I guess if Trump and Carson hang in there, but I just don't think that they can really be candidates. I think this is still the cartoon.
But we've been saying that for months.
I see this coming down to Trump versus Rubio. I really do.
4 years ago, Herman Cain was kicking ass. 4 years ago, Herman. I mean, I'm telling you, it doesn't matter. We're a year out yet.
Herman Cain was kicking ass for like 2 weeks, and we all talked about those 2 weeks. Like, oh, this was an incredible 2 weeks for Herman Cain. and then it was over. Trump has been kicking ass for 5 months now.
I still don't, it's very different. I still don't think real Republicans can pull the lever. I could be wrong.
I have dinner like once a week with someone. My father, cough, and talks about like, oh, he's really telling it like it is, and blah blah blah. Hey, we really do need a wall. Cough. I mean, it's crazy.
Donald Trump has a ceiling. He can't get above.
I agree.
He's never been above 33%.
He only needs 33% for most of these for the beginning. And if there's six or seven people who stay in,
there aren't going to be.
DJ, that is a theory, and it may prove true, but it's just true. A theory. This idea that there's a ceiling for any one of these candidates is just not. It's not based on any data. You know, you could say, well, his negatives are too high, but his negatives are actually coming down and they're getting closer to his positives. So, listen, I don't know that Donald Trump is going to be the nominee.
He's moderating his message a little bit, too. He's not.
Very much so.
You know, so I think he even believes that, oh, wow, maybe I should actually try this. Because I think in the beginning, it really was all about just like the ego trip. And all of a sudden, I don't think he even thought he would do as well as he is now.
No, I don't think so.
But yeah. I just don't believe like a real Republican is going to be able to pull the lever for him.
Well, here's the thing you have to remember about the way Republicans nominate delegates in this. Each congressional district gets three delegates, every single one, including Kevin, the ones in your home city of Los Angeles that haven't sent a Republican to Congress in decades. In most of these, in fact, I think in almost all of them, for those districts, it's winner take all. So if Cruz, Carson, and Trump all split the conservative vote and Rubio gets 35% to 40% and they split the rest, Rubio gets all three of those congressional delegates. And in places like Massachusetts, New York, other parts of New England, Oregon, Washington, California, you're going to see a lot of places where the conservative wing of the party is not as strong as the moderate wing of the party or the established wing or whatever it is. And they get three delegates too, each congressional district. There was something, I think, I don't remember who had it on 538.com, but they talked about basically a built-in establishment moderate advantage in Republican primaries. And whether it's Rubio or Bush, and that's why people are focusing on Rubio or Bush and essentially the establishment primary. Because at some point after South Carolina, if one of them beats the other in all those three early states, then that's Republican donors and Republican voters of that wing would say, okay, that's our guy.
Well,
and
again,
that'll give him a built-in advantage.
That may come to pass, but right now it's just a theory. And frankly, personally, I think it's a theory because nobody can imagine Donald Trump being the nominee of the Republican Party.
But we've crushed this tonight.
Is there anything else we need to cover? Or?
We actually covered the Democrats earlier, too, so I think we're good.
Is it fair that although Lindsey Graham is running, that he's just kicked off these debates? I mean, it's
tremendously fair.
It's tremendously. Is this like is it like old Yeller, take him out around back?
Lindsey Graham's not, he's not going to, he never wanted to be president anyhow. He's not going anywhere. He'll still be the same guy. My thing is like, why didn't they do it earlier?
Okay. What about Christie? Is it fair for Christie?
Absolutely.
We never actually talked about it because
he had a bunch of great appearances in the debates and his numbers didn't go anywhere. So sorry. Voted off the island, fat boy.
The problem is
you set a limit. 5% in the polls are better. You're not in a debate. That's the problem. The parties didn't have the cojones to do that.
Yeah.
The Democrats didn't have the issue. Yeah. Lincoln Chafee solved that for them.
That's right.
But
totally.
But that's the problem. You have to have a standard. This is running for president of the United States.
I agree.
You know how many people are two-term governors? Do you know how many people are ex-senators? They can't all just say, you know what? I'm going to run and I get to be on stage with the big boys.
Yeah.
So that's where it went bad.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
Fair enough.
All right.
I just testing the water.
Let's wrap it up. But as we wrap it up, everyone's got to vote in just because we do this every once in a while. Who's the Republican nominee in the one who goes up against Hillary? Who's the Republican nominee?
Lindsey Graham.
Okay, Greg, who's the Republican?
You know, I've been saying Trump recently. just to get just under like everybody's nerves. But you know, Rubio's my guy. Rubio's my guy. I'm going to stick with him. And everyone better pay up when he wins.
DJ, you're saying Rubio?
I agree. I think it's Rubio.
I think it's Rubio too.
Rubio. Okay. Yeah, it's Clinton Rubio. It's the classic matchup, the young John Kennedy-esque GOPer versus the old female.
Even with his credit cards. It's Rubio.
Yeah.
All right, guys, we killed it tonight. So we'll talk to you again next week. And so before you guys, as we go, head over to the website, moreperfectpodcast.com, facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast, and go to iTunes, rate and review us. We deserve it. We broke a sweat tonight, people. We deserve it. So thank you guys again, and we will talk to you next week. Thank you for listening to the More Perfect Union Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and check out the website at moreperfectunionpodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for the More Perfect Union Podcast crew, you can email us at moreperfectunionpodcast@gmail.com. We'll talk to you next week.